This week's show with Krista West of Avlia Folk Embroidery is sponsored by Sassy Jack Stitchery, your source for all of the new charts from the Nashville market. If you didn't pre-order, Kim will have in stock or be able to quickly order any of the new charts introduced in Nashville. While she's shipping out Nashville orders, Kim and the amazing Everett are putting the finishing touches on the Baird House so the live shopping can begin. Sassy Jack's also has two workshops coming up. In May, the talented Jeanette Douglas will present a virtual workshop, and in June, Hands On Design will present a live workshop. Sign up for those events at sassyjackstitchery.com. Keep up to date with all that's happening by following the Sassy Jack's Facebook group or by subscribing to the Sassy Jack's newsletter. While you're at sassyjackstitchery.com, sign up for the Cosmo Thread Club and join the Sassy Jack's Customer Loyalty Club. Thanks to the folks at Sassy Jack's for sponsoring this show, and note that you can purchase Avlia charts and kits from Sassy Jack's. This week's guest, Krista West, will also be with us live on the Fiber Talk Stitch Hour this Wednesday, March 20 at 8 p.m. Eastern. In the Stitch Hour, we'll be able to see and talk about many of the new things we discuss in this show, particularly the work bags and the upcoming Folk Flourishes kits. Now, our conversation with Krista West of Avlia Folk Embroidery. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week, Krista West, Avlia Folk Embroidery. Krista, welcome.
Thank you. It's so great to be on the show again.
I couldn't believe it when we put this together. We've only done one of these shows, and that was in November 2019.
Wow.
I thought, wow. But, I mean, we've done several Wednesday shows, live shows. I don't know, two, three, four, maybe. I don't know. But I couldn't believe it. That was the first time we talked to you, was in 2019. And, yeah, you were just getting things going, and holy smokes.
It's been a really busy few years.
Yeah, I'll say.
Great way. Yeah, it's just, boy, if I would have known in 2019 how many changes were ahead, I wouldn't have believed it.
Yeah, you were just kind of, just really almost, I don't know if this is the right term, but you're just kind of picking at it and giving it a try.
Oh, 100%.
I had some great ideas.
I thought Avlia was going to be this hobby business I would do when I retired. That was really, I thought, I'm just going to do this. I'm going to design some of these. This is going to be kind of fun. And I'm just going to kind of keep it off to the side over here. And then, you know, when I eventually retire out of custom tailoring, then I can like pick this up. And that didn't happen. So.
Yeah. Well, now it pretty much consumes you, right?
Yeah. Basically, what really gave us traction was the pandemic, with so many people wanting to stay home and make things. You know, I was one of those designers that kind of got discovered during the pandemic, like a lot of people. And yeah, things just snowballed, have just been growing ever since. We basically now ship in a month what we shipped in like all of 2019. So it's been a real change, but a great one. I mean, I feel very, very blessed and very fortunate to get to do this. It totally took me by surprise. I never intended to like do this, but here we are. So
what's that like? I mean, that's so November 2019 when we talked to you, and they got a pandemic in there. I mean, that is rapid growth. What's that like to manage that? That's got to be.
It's a lot to manage. Fortunately, it was not my first rodeo. And so I felt like I went into it knowing where the signposts were going to be and what I needed to do. And that's because when I started doing custom tailoring, which that website launched in 1998, the first 5 years of my doing custom tailoring, I grew 40% every single year. Whoa. And I did it while I had little kids underfoot. So that was one of the craziest periods of my life. So I was able to kind of build on that experience. I knew what rapid growth felt like, and I had made mistakes the first time around that I didn't want to make again. Things like, you know, just getting completely consumed in work and not having a work-life balance and things like that. So this time around, I was watching for it. And as soon as it started happening, I was like, okay, I know what this is. And then I really started planning. I haven't really gotten out in front of everything. Like, there's been some things that have taken me by surprise. But for the most part, I felt better prepared because of my previous experience. And so really what happened is by, it would have been like by 2021, there were so many Avlia orders coming in that I was working 10 and 12 hour days, and I knew it wasn't sustainable.
Right.
And so my husband and I really started talking, and the funny thing is that all of this happening actually ended up helping me accomplish something that I had wanted to accomplish for all of my career in custom tailoring. And so it was just this kind of crazy series of events and some like chance conversations that my husband and I had, because I told him, I said, okay, Avlia's like starting to take off. And if like this becomes a thing, like, and there are only so many hours in the day, and I can't wear all the hats, I can't do everything. And I have a tendency to want to wear all the hats, and I've had to learn to dial that down. And so my husband was like, well, is there any way that you could like create standard sizes of like your vestments and your liturgical garments? And I was like, no, that just can't be done. I was like in total custom tailor brain. I was like, that absolutely cannot be done. That cannot be done, because that is just going to mess with our craftsmanship. And I was kind of in my little ivory tower, and I had to kind of get over myself.
What's that like up there? You know, when you got it all figured out?
I have it all figured out. I had my whole system. And the system was all custom. But the thing is that's a very expensive system. So for me to basically be the one person handling all the correspondence, all the measurements, the everything, and every single order is literally reinventing the wheel. And it's very, very time consuming. And so my husband was like, you know, why can't you like kind of like be like the rest of the garment industry and like actually create sizes? And I was like, well, it can't be done because of people's heights, because you might have two guys that are the same build, but one's 2 inches taller than the other or 3 inches shorter or something. And my husband was one who came up with the idea. He's like, what if you just leave the garments, the hem, unfinished? He goes, men's pants used to always be done that way. And that was the total like watershed moment. And as soon as I wrap my mind around that, I'm like, oh, well, yeah, then standard sizing isn't a problem at all. So Avlia really forced me, because I just didn't have enough hours in the day. It forced me to get really efficient and kind of push myself to streamline and become much more efficient at my tailoring work. And ultimately, it solved this big problem, because for years, the thing about tailoring work that I hated the most, it was the one thing I absolutely hated about my work, was that it was so expensive for people. I don't think in 28 years of tailoring, a month has gone by where someone hasn't emailed me and said, is there any way you can reduce the price? We need this. Can we get it cheaper? You know, and that's a huge part of the custom tailoring world. It's like, it's already like, I'm already like, I wasn't even making as much as people who do like custom tailored suits or things like that. It was already as low as we could go.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a real challenge. And so I was thrilled when we figured out standardized sizing, because it allowed us to start using a production facility and producing garments in quantity, and it dropped the price drastically. So making my design, my garments, and the fact that I was overseeing the quality and the fit and things like that was now available to way, way, way more people. Yeah. And so basically a custom tailored cassock went from being $600 and you have to wait 8 weeks for it, to basically being $165 and you can buy it now and have it on Friday.
Wow.
And yeah.
And the churches, I mean, I keep on thinking of the churches here. You know, they're not, you know, they're not rich. I don't know if the vestments
go. Churches are not rich. No, that's exactly the point. I mean, it's heartbreaking. It is actually, I will tell you from personal experience, it is soul killing to be in a field where you're trying to do your very best work, and the people that need your very best work, it slowly grinds you down. And most tailors I've known over the years, they just retire in their 50s, because it's also pretty hard on the body. A lot of long hours standing on your feet, repetitive motion injuries, everything's cut by hand, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I really thought I was just going to join that group and basically be, okay, I'm hanging up the scissors, I'm just done now. And so this actually for me this was such a great thing to have happen in my life, because I felt like I could actually share the knowledge and all the experience and expertise I'd built up over the years. I could share it with more people at a much more affordable price point. And it was funny because my husband, you know, I kind of have this trend. I thought, well, it's not going to really be that big of a deal. You know, we'll sell a few cassocks here and there, but like, at least we can still, you know, provide these garments to people and these vestments and things like that. And it just totally exploded. Once people figured out they could get my garment design, which I kind of refined over the years, and get it for $165, yeah, it just kind of took off. And so my husband's taken over all of that. So he pretty much manages all of that. And Pamela, our workshop assistant, she now helps too. Like, she'll help with order fulfillment if he's busy doing other stuff. And so, yeah, and I'm still very much involved. Like, we're actually getting ready this year to do a whole new product, a whole new garment line. And I like him doing all the pattern drafting and the development for that. But that's a really discrete task. And that's like something I can block out, you know, a week to do or whatever. Yeah. It's instead of me just basically being on deck for 10 hours a day.
Well, you mentioned Pamela. I mean, that's another one of those milestones where you realize you have to hire someone just so you can live.
Oh, so, and I was so scared of the process. It's funny. I've worked with probably off and on anywhere from 3 to 9 sewing subcontractors over the years with my custom tailoring. So I was used to managing people. That wasn't a problem for me. But this is my house. My studio is in my house. Yeah. And this is where I live. And this is, you know, where sometimes I show up to work in my workout clothes because I didn't have a chance to take a shower. And like, this is like real me. And I was really nervous as a family. And we're kind of a family of introverts. So we're like, people in our space? Oh my God, like, we can't take that. And so I was really nervous about it, but I was like, we have to do this. Like, we just don't have a choice. And so I put out, it was funny, I sent out a text to a bunch of my neighbors and said, hey, does anybody know anybody who might be looking for a part-time job? And my neighbor across the street, Pamela, she's my favorite neighbor. And she was like, excuse me, but like, I'm looking for a part-time job. And I'm like, yes. And it's just been, it was just like perfect from the first minute she stepped into the workshop. And she just keeps me on track, and she does a lot of, well, she does most of the order fulfillment. She makes kits. She helps customers, and she stitches some of the samples because she loves to stitch. She's just incredible. And I couldn't really have, there's no way I could have gotten to this place where we're at now. We're able to release, you know, new designs every month and all that kind of stuff without her.
Yeah. Well, I know from my little interaction with her, attention to detail, and this is really trivial, but you're so kind to send kits and charts for us to give away on the Wednesday shows. And she sends them. And one of the things when I get new stuff is I hate opening it, you know, because it's supposed to be new. And she sends them, and she doesn't close the envelope so that I can show them on the air. And I thought, oh, thank you. You know, just a trivial little detail. But that's someone who's really paying attention, because
very much so.
Yeah.
And she gets that. And that's important to her. And that's a huge part of what we're about at Avlia. It's like, we serge the edges of all the fabric, because that way you don't have to think about it when you open it. And things like, we staple the needle to a little scrap of fabric on a card. We don't put it in the fabric because it can rust. If you're in places in the South and it's humid, that needle can rust in the fabric. And, you know, if you take 6 months to open up your kit, you put it in your stash, you've now ruined the fabric with these rust marks.
Right.
And
right.
So, yeah, Pamela has such an attention to detail. And she's just an incredibly kind person. You know, if there's a customer issue, she will just go to the ends of the world to like get that fixed and resolved. I mean, right now she is doing an epic battle with the Postal Service over a $200 package to a customer that arrived at the customer's with nothing in it. Literally everything had been opened and all the kits were missing.
Oh, no.
And all the packaging was there, but everything was gone. And she's like, I mean, epic battle. So she's on it. And I was like, I don't even have to think about this. It's so great. So, yeah. You know, I'm going off and thinking about designs, and she's dealing with the Postal Service. And it's been great for her too, because it was actually really great. A few months after I hired her, her husband was out working in the yard and I was out working in the yard. And he just came over and he said, you know, thank you. Thank you so much for hiring her. He goes, she feels like she is valued and appreciated in a way that she's never been in any other job. And I was like, oh my gosh, I was like kind of taken aback. And I was like, seriously, like, I feel like I'm the one who like is so grateful to have her. So it's been really great. It's been a really great thing for both of us. And she's right across the street. So, yeah. You know, we joke that like we don't get snow days, you know, because like if it's snowing or if there's ice, you know, well, still have to come to work. But yeah, so she's been a huge asset at Avlia. And we just have such a, we just work together really, really well. I love having her in my space. And I can totally trust her. And it's just been this really great thing. I feel like that's kind of been the theme of the last couple of years for me is like, Krista, let go. Krista, let go and welcome in some other people to the workshop. And that's been a really good thing for me. I mean, I've really grown as a person by having to basically just admit I cannot do everything myself.
Yeah, that can be tough. That can be tough. Yep.
Oh, it is. Yep. It is.
So talk about now, you started out with your initial designs and your whole design work has just evolved dramatically in the 4 years, 5 years, whatever it is. Talk about how that's been in your head of.
Wow. Okay, well, when I started designing my first designs, I literally was using colored pencils on graph paper. So I've come a long ways and had to learn every aspect of that. I got charting software. I use WinStitch. I love WinStitch. I love Jim over at Ursa Software is amazing. We are on a first name basis. And as far as evolving as a designer, I mean, those first designs, it's funny. Over the last couple of months, I've been revisiting some of my earliest designs and looking at how I would do them differently now. And I'm working on creating some like additional variations. I'll keep the original patterns, of course, because people love those. But looking at ways that I would do it now that I know what I know after receiving so much customer feedback. And so that's really helpful. The people who send in emails and are like, hey, I love this design, but you know, would you ever think about making it a smaller version? Or would you ever think about doing this or that or the other thing? Sometimes that really helps. I'm like, oh, that wouldn't have occurred to me. Also, just doing more orders shows me what people are looking for. And I think the thing that's been so exciting to me is that here at Avlia, we have an incredibly wide demographic of stitchers. So we have everything from high schoolers to people, you know, into their 80s. Because boho is having such a moment, maximalism is a big trend right now in interior design, and people are sort of rediscovering folk embroidery. And that's bringing us a lot of younger stitchers. So all of that has really influenced my design because I want to balance. I want to be able to do those huge, like 30,000 stitch designs that are very true to the original textiles, like out of my personal collection or pictures that friends send me, things like that. But I also want to do smaller things so that somebody who is just getting started isn't intimidated, that they feel like they are just as welcome at the folk embroidery table. And so for me, it's just a matter of looking at all of that. I've also worked really hard over the last couple of years to build up my personal library of photos that friends send me, reference works, and vintage textiles. So I've just been able to do more and more of that so that I can be. So yeah, it really is. And I feel like I have a much, in the early days, I felt like I just had to really faithfully recreate what I was seeing. Now I feel like a lot more, I look at the design and think, okay, how can I interpret this? Or what can this inspire? So it has really changed me as a designer. And also then you have the practical element of actually running an embroidery kit business and something like, you know, figuring out that, okay, our fabric is technically 70 inches wide, but with the selvages, it's really only 69 usable inches. And so what happens when we create a kit that, you know, we have 7 extra inches, you know, of that fabric, because we're bringing over all of our fabric from Greece. And so it's expensive to get it here. So we have to make sure that we literally use every inch. And pretty much every inch does get used. So, you know, I'm always really concerned about keeping the kit price low. That's important to me that it's accessible for people and affordable. And so that, like, that also influences my design. You know, I can't really just design oh, I'm just going to make whatever I'm going to make. I have to think about how is it going to get into somebody's hands.
Yeah.
So my design evolved.
The ground cloth, you know, every shop in the world has a basket full of little scraps that you can get for a song that are left over from just that very thing that they have to cut. And then they have a piece that if you want to play with it, fine, but it's useless to us. And so the better you can manage that, the better your material costs.
Yeah. And we do scrap bags, and honestly, we have trouble keeping them in stock on the website. We oftentimes have more people wanting scrap bags than we actually have scrap to create them. And then even if we have that little tiny salvage piece left, we put that in a basket, and that's what we use for making needle carts, like the little piece of fabric that your needle goes through. So when I say every inch is used, we literally use every inch.
Well, and I love your kits. I was was teaching my niece how to sew, and actually by the time we were done, she said she wanted to learn to cross stitch, but it turns out what she really wanted was a finished product. She wanted a bag. And I was like, if I could have found an Oblea kit at both of those shops I went to, I would have bought her one, like one of your work bags or something, because it would have been all there, all her threads, the needle, the instructions. So that way, I'm there to hold her hand. She'd have everything. And then she'd have that bag when she was done that she'd stitched, or, even a little kit that I stuck in the bag, and she'd have two things to do. But it because that was the thing. She didn't want to have something that she had to try to figure out how to finish on her own,
That is such a good point. That's a great point. And I think, honestly, that is something that totally came as a shock to me with Avlia. And it's because I approached folk embroidery from the Greek position, which is everything is designed to be practical and used. It had never occurred to me that when I went to my first trade show and I saw almost every sample framed behind glass, that looked so foreign to me, because I was used to seeing embroideries always finished into something that got used around the house. And so it was kind of funny because it didn't even occur to me until until into the pandemic that I realized, wait, that's the thing that makes us unique, is that we're helping people figure out how to actually use the thing you've made. And I think that is such an important part of textiles. We only have so much wall space. People's homes and interiors are changing. They want to change things up more. And folk embroidery really fits the bill for that. I have cushion covers that I put out, and then I might change them out or change to different ones. And when I, change out those cushion covers, it's real simple to just take the one I'm not using and fold it up and put it in a drawer. Very easy to hand them down or give them away, that sort of a thing. And I just hadn't realized that was such a huge appeal, and there was such a need out there in the crafting community for people like me to sort of say, hey, you can use this thing here. Let me help you figure out how to finish it. Like my draw and thread video, I was stunned at the response to that. I couldn't believe that so many people didn't know that technique. I thought I was kind of, just teaching the obvious, preaching to the choir. And instead, I still probably every couple of weeks get an email from someone who's like, I saw your video. I finally did it. I did it. And it's so easy. And I'm like, yeah, it's really not hard.
Right.
And so that was huge to me, figuring out that need to use your stuff practically was there.
Yeah. And actually, I've got to say, I just finished my Blue Larkspur piece, and I unstitched it and I gave it a good bath, and it's like, perfect. I can put it out here for Easter. It's done.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's it. I think the other thing too is I think the embroidery community needed somebody like me saying, just use the embroidery. Just use it. Who cares? It's going to get a stain. It's going to get something on it, and it's okay. Life will go on. You'll make more things. And for example, one of the very first folk embroiders I did, probably the third or fourth one I did, was this huge 3-foot by 3-foot square with what's now our Byzantine rose border design. And I put it out very carefully at Christmas. First Christmas my son-in-law was with us, he sets down a coffee cup and spills coffee on it.
Oh.
And it's so funny. And at first I had this panic moment, but as the years have gone, I washed it and most of it came out, but there's this little faint stain. And every Christmas now, when I put that out, I think of Lucas and when he first joined our family. And it actually is this memory now that's really, it's a treasured memory for me. And I think we need to stop being afraid of our textiles. Like, use them. We've always, as human beings, we've interacted with our textiles. That's what we want to do.
And you know, now I go to estate sales and you see all these linens that people have kept pristinely and they never used them. And, you know, mm-hmm. and going for a song at estate sales.
Mm-hmm.
Because people are like, well, we just don't use that anymore. Use your stuff. It's like you might
use
as well.
Use your stuff. Use the good dishes. Exactly. Life is short. Use the embroidery. That's sort of my motto.
Yes, absolutely.
Like, I say that, and we have a boxer. Our dog is a boxer, and seriously, they are so slimy, and they, you know, will occasionally slime stuff. I went in the other day into my living room, and she had slimed one of my pillows, and I'm like, oh, darn her. It comes off. I washed it. It was fine. But then I was like, nope, you know, I got to walk the talk. Like, I'm using my pillows, and like, I've got my dog, and I've got my 13-year-old, and like, it's okay. It's all going to be okay. My life is going to be better. For me, at least, if I surround myself with textiles. And that means there's going to be a little mess.
Yep. Yeah. How many sets of expensive wedding gift china are out there that have been used twice? Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Just sitting in a china cabinet collecting dust. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And I do think that this is a huge part of what's going to draw a younger demographic and is drawing a younger demographic to stitching and crafting is this practical aspect. I think that a lot of them, they don't want to be, you know, they don't want to have all the good stuff just tucked away in a drawer. They want to use it. They want to enjoy it. And I think that's actually one. I just think that's such a great thing that the younger generation, sort of an influence that they are bringing into the crafting community. They're like, show us how to use it. Show us how to use it. And I'm like, yes, they want the color and the vibrancy and all the things in their life on a daily basis. They don't want to wait for a special occasion. And I actually feel like that's a really good thing.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It still gets me when I go to your website. All your product shots are these pieces in use, and there's still for me that there's that pause because as I'm stitching stuff, you know, don't get it dirty, don't wrinkle it, don't. And then we go to Avlia, and yeah, use it. Put a flower pot on top of it. Put a basket of whatever on top of it and use the thing. And then you look at how those designs enhance whatever's sitting on top of them and make the table or the whatever surface it is just so much more pleasing.
Oh, absolutely. Textiles for me are sort of part of like a multimedia presentation. I like to actually mix them with flowers or old books or plants or glassware or things I thrift. I love thrifting. And actually one of the things I adore about Avlia is that it actually gives me permission to thrift, which is great. Love that. And so I feel like, yeah, that for me, I almost never put a textile down and don't put something on top of it. And that's like how I'm used to seeing them. You know, that's also why, like, I do a lot of table runner designs. Cause like, even in my own house, I want to put something in the middle. I want that negative space, that open space in the middle. Cause I'm going to stick something in the middle of it. I'm going to put a brass candlestick, or maybe I'm going to put a photo of my kid's wedding or something like that. It's something's going to go in it. The textile isn't just going to be this kind of rarefied museum piece all on its own. You know, it's going to be, you know, kind of joined in the whole mosh pit of my house. And that's what I think is like so compelling to people. And that's what I want to like really help encourage people is mix it up, put stuff on it, use it. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, no, it's great. When the pandemic hit, what did that do to your design work? Did that give you a period of time to develop more stuff, or did you just get so busy it was crazy? Because I know a lot of shops couldn't keep up, but
yeah. Oh, that's a really good question. Well, okay, let's see. We hired Pamela that would have been 2 years ago. So that was 2022. So it got pretty busy in the pandemic. Things really started to take off. So I was doing a lot of kits, and I had not at that point in time during the pandemic really figured out how to set aside specific time to design. So I was still very much in my design by the seat of my pants mode. And I think honestly, like I wasn't taking myself seriously kind of yet as being someone who is an artist who creates embroidery patterns. And so I wasn't really dedicating that time. So a lot of the pandemic for me was kind of same old.
Wait, back up. You weren't, mm-hmm. you okay. That, you know, all right, set the pandemic aside. taking yourself serious as a designer, that there was an evolution there too.
Oh, huge for me. Oh, huge. Oh, huge. Yeah. It's very funny because actually in the custom tailoring world, I never really fully identified as an artist because it's such a craftsman-based kind of work model. It's like you learn under a tailor. It's a master apprenticeship model. And so I never felt like I could say that I was an artist, really, until I started designing for Avlia. So it still feels very new to me to kind of identify myself that way. So, I guess it probably does sound funny, but to me, that's been a very recent evolution for me to say, wait a second, what I'm doing is actually artistic, and I need to, it's okay for me to devote time to do it. I grew up blue collar. So for me, it's all about the work. It's about getting the work done. And so for me to basically say, okay, it's Wednesday, I'm designing all day, nobody talk to me. That's kind of new for me. So yeah, I know that sounds, I guess it does sound really funny. Yeah. So like the designing has always like kind of fit in the cracks of my life. But during the pandemic that did start to change for me. And of course, hiring Pamela was when I finally got time to like sit down. Oh no, I was literally for the first probably 3 years of Avlia, I was doing designing in the evenings or on the weekends, or I'd, you know, find a day here and there. I'd wait till I got sick. Like no joke. Like I just I didn't have dedicated design time. And that for me has been kind of like, that's the part of my work right now that I still have to like pinch myself. I wake up in the morning like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I get to do this. Because it's something that I did for years, but I always did it all around all the other things. The pandemic, though, in general, wasn't very difficult for me because it was actually kind of funny for me because I'm like, oh, yeah, now everybody knows what it's like to work from home. I mean, I'd been working from home at that point for 25 years, and I dealt with screaming kids while you're on the phone or a Zoom. Like that, I was like, been there, done that for decades. So for me, the pandemic really wasn't, I didn't actually have a lot of difficulty because I had already refined my work from home kind of method over years. Yeah. So I would say if anything, I actually really appreciated the fact that more people knew what it was like to kind of live a work from home lifestyle. For me, that's been actually really nice because for years I would say, well, I'm a tailor, you know, and I have a studio in my home and people just look at you blankly. They're like, what? But they just had no reference point for what that looked like. And for years and years and years, people just thought I like did alterations in my basement. And I'm like, no, actually, I'm doing like big commissions that are going out to cathedrals, like, you know, just here in the basement. But like, that was how I worked. So I really actually appreciated during the pandemic how much respect work from home finally got.
Yeah. There's a picture. Men who got forced to work from home with the kids around during the pandemic and could, you know, just driving them nuts, and their wives going, what's your problem? This is normal. Just get it done. Yeah.
Totally. Okay. My older daughters tell stories about growing up playing, you know, under the cutting table. So, you know, they literally grew up in the workshop. And, you know, honestly, it's kind of funny. My older girls now are, let's see, this year they'll be 26 and 24. And, you know, they're at that point in life where you kind of go, oh, wow, there's some stuff I really would have changed or done differently, or, you know, things that you feel like, oh, wow, I'm really sorry that, like, I wasn't a great parent in this arena or that arena. But it's kind of funny. Over just the last couple of months, my middle daughter, Nora, and I have been chatting about, like, what was it like to, like, grow up in the workshop? And she actually has told me, you know, honestly, I wouldn't have traded it for the world. She goes, it was a great way to grow up. She goes, you know, I as the mom wasn't always like available. And oftentimes I was like involved in a creative project or whatever I was doing, but she's like, you were always there. She said, you were always there and there's always something going on. And it was like interesting and active. And yeah, so I actually feel really grateful for having been able to do a work from home environment. It's always worked very well for me.
It's nice being with the kids. I mean, I think I always laugh when I hear people say, oh, the kids are home for spring break. I'm like, yeah, because I homeschooled mine. I was like, yeah, they're always here. You know, what do you mean? So,
I know.
Yeah.
I feel the same way. Yeah. Yeah. It's so funny. I can totally relate. Because when I was right before I turned 40, I got pregnant with my last and our youngest daughter, Georgia. And I had a friend at the time tell me, oh man, I'm so sorry for you. You're never going to have an empty nest. And I looked at her and said, oh my gosh, that's so exciting. I'm never going to have an empty nest. So, you know, one person perceives it one way and another person perceives it another way. I like having my house full of my kids and my family and all the stuff. It definitely like makes my work feel really lively.
Yeah, this is what you get used to.
We did a show recently with the folks from Honduras Threads, where they're helping the ladies down in Honduras build a business and through needlework. And one of the things that has stuck with me from those, we did two shows with them, was that there is no, that they know of, no indigenous needlework embroidery design from the history of Honduras.
Isn't it all weaving?
I don't know. I mean, there just isn't, apparently is no, like, let's draw on your culture and your history and create designs. There's none of it. And then I look at you and all you draw from Greece and Eastern Europe, and it's like, oh good, we're keeping these designs, these color schemes, these patterns alive through needlework. And it's such a contrast, because what a shame to have an entire culture and country that has lost I mean, it had to be there at one point.
Yes.
What
yes.
happened to it? And then, like, your work, I mean, you draw so much from other sources, and it's keeping its own form of history alive.
Oh yeah. In all, I have now like over 120 designs, and the only one that doesn't come from a folk embroidery background is the Oak Park Diamonds. And that I did from a leaded glass window, which comes from an East Lake architecture design. So even that, like, I'm like, oh, I'm always looking backwards into history. This is a huge part of the satisfaction of running and promoting Avlia, is just seeing, I feel like I have tapped into this amazing community of people who want this too. They want to keep these designs alive. They still appreciate them. And it's funny, because like every once in a while I'll be in, you know, embroidery or making circles, and people will kind of get along that little track of like, oh, nobody's crafting anymore. And like, they're all, you know, kind of in that space. And I'm like, huh, really? Would you like to come over and like join us and do order fulfillment? You know, would you like to like see our demographics? Like, no, this is changing. And I think that there is such a wonderful appreciation for history and culture in the younger generations. I mean, we have it in you know, our generation as well. And I love that. But I get emails all the time from Avlia customers, things along the lines of, oh, this reminds me of what my yaya, my grandma, my nana made for me when I was little. And I'm so grateful that I can do this now too. And it's just, that's huge. I mean, I do that and I'm thinking, yeah, that's why I'm getting up in the morning and going to work. This is such a satisfying thing, because my aesthetic formation and training as an ecclesiastical tailor is in the Byzantine artisan model, which we are very much trained that we are links in a chain, that you are being handed something and you will work on it and then you will pass it on to the next generation. And this happens not just in, this happens like in wood carving, and it happens in iconography and in vestments and liturgical garments and metalsmithing and things like that. There's this understanding that the tradition is sacred. And I don't mean sacred in the sense of just only being within the church, but I mean sacred as in the sense of being holy, being special, being an awesome thing filled with awe. And that is the part that for a long time, because I was so immersed in the ecclesiastical tailoring world, one of my frustrations there was that it felt like it was relegated only to church use. And every year I would get somebody who was like, well, I love this stuff, but I'd love to have it in my home. And when I discovered folk embroidery and saw, wait, this is the way traditionally that people have these things in their home. For me, that was just like, that was part of why it was just love at first sight. It was like, yes, we can bring this beauty. We can bring this historical motifs and geometry and these patterns, these things that we've lived with as humans for thousands and thousands of years. And you can have them in your, you can have them on your dining room table. You can, you know, be sipping your Starbucks and you can be looking at that, you know, embroidery you made that references maybe, like, for example, the Iris's paint box design. I designed it as a table runner because an Avlia customer sent a photo to me of a design that she had bought in Greece. She'd actually had a woman stitch it for her in the 1970s. Her version had the design as a double-ended table runner. So the design was at two ends of like a large table scarf. When I went to go and dig a little deeper, I discovered that the original design actually came from a folk costume sleeve from an island in Greece. So we see this like journey that this one design takes. And now people, you know, all over the US are stitching Iris's paint box for their, you know, buffets or their living room table, their entryway table or whatever. And so that design gets to keep going on and on and on. And for me, this is a huge part of like why I make is to like keep, you know, to pass these things on to the next generation.
Yeah, that history thing, Cindy and I in the Wednesday show just this past Wednesday probably spent too much time on it. But it was the history and how we learn history, where your school books are the, you know, the standard fare. But then there's so much more, and it's so much more interesting to learn history through these kinds of things, through needlework and art, and we just don't get to do it, and mm-hmm. we miss out on the human connection, like a piece. This came from a sleeve design. You know, mm-hmm. Now I'm connected with that person, and yeah,
exactly. And I think that actually, it's funny. I've been reading a book on the concept of awe, A-W-E, awe. And he made the neuroscientist who's writing the book makes the point that one of the things that that visual design is a way that we experience awe, and part of that process is actually feeling connected with other people throughout history. And that's huge for me. I rarely sit down and work on a design without thinking about the women who have stitched this through the centuries and thinking, where were they? Like, what did they do? What did they make? For, you know, what did they eat for breakfast that morning? What did they sit around and gossip about? You know, what was the talk of the town or the village or whatever? Like, what were their lives like? That's a huge part of the appeal of folk embroidery to me, is I feel like I'm kind of getting to dip my toe in this huge river that like winds through human history. That is about textiles. It really elevates it. And I think it gives it a real sense of meaning and purpose. And I think it's part of what people are drawn to.
Yeah, I think so. You know, and so much of your design has come from Greece, but are you starting to explore other cultures?
Yeah, yes, I am definitely exploring other cultures. I'm now adding other countries to my list of textiles that I'm acquiring for my own personal collection. So like recently I acquired a series of five Ukrainian embroideries, and I was able to adapt all of those. And sometimes I'm finding things that are like from the 70s or the 60s, and the colors or the quality of the stitching or the threads are really poor, or the colors are really light, bright, very like, you know, day glow orange. And I'm adapting those for a more modern interior. Doesn't mean that somebody can't, you know, somebody's always can stitch whatever colors they want. But when I'm looking at it, I'm trying to think, well, sometimes you can't see a design because of the colors that it's been stitched in, especially those ones that are very associated with specific eras and time periods in history, like the 1960s and the 1970s, those day glow oranges and lime greens and things like that. Sometimes you have to actually tune up the colors to be able to kind of let the design be able to really see it again. Sometimes there's too much contrast and it's almost like it's too blazingly bright and you can't really see the different interconnections within the design. So that's something that I really enjoy doing. Yeah. So right now I've done Bulgarian. Well, my release in February was Bulgarian. Sophia Tulip is actually from a Bulgarian textile in my personal collection. And, I paired that with Chios Crisscross, which is actually a Greek island design. And I'm doing more Ukrainian because people are also asking us for Ukrainian designs, and I'm really trying to meet that need. And I've done Latvian a number of years ago, actually. A friend found me a huge cache of like 30 pre-World War II Latvia needlework booklets. And they're fantastic. So, but it's so funny to me how many times I open them up and I go, wow, that design, I know that design from this Greek island piece. Like, it's such a shared world. And you see the same designs and elements like all over. I can't tell you the times I've seen a design labeled as absolutely 100% Greek one place. And then you see it in another book, absolutely 100% Saxon Transylvania. So, but the thing is like, we don't know where these come from all the time. And it's a very shared collective world. So I'm always, while I will always try and label something like from where I received the design or where I know it came from, at least the provenance of whatever I'm working with, I like to really be very careful about saying this is 100% absolutely Greek. We just don't know. You know, in a lot of cases, unless something has actually been handed down person to person to person with a perfect provenance, we don't always know exactly where it came from. And we certainly don't always know where the inspiration came from. Even Greek island textiles, in the 1700s, there was a huge maritime industry. There's tons of seagoing vessels going in and out. Patterns from France and Venice were coming into Greek islands, and the reverse, Greek island designs were going into France and Venice. So there has always been this very large artistic interchange throughout the Mediterranean. What a lot of people forget, well, and a lot of people just aren't aware of this piece of history, is that before Constantinople fell in 1453, Constantinople was a center for artisans for a millennia. We're talking 1,000 years of artisan production. They had some of the finest silk workshops in the world. The Byzantine draw loom technology still has not been understood by modern PhD scholars. Like, still don't understand how the Byzantine draw loom exactly worked because it was so sophisticated. And a lot of people think, well, Constantinople fell, everything's over. No, Constantinople fell and there were refugees. And these artisans went out as refugees all across Europe. And so you have this dissemination of Byzantine aesthetics going out that literally affects us like all the way into today. I think it's something like every major court in Europe, at least one piece of their court vesture actually can be traced directly in a straight line back to the Byzantine court garment tradition. So we forget this. We think that it's like an era ended and it just ended. It's like, no, there were real people who really knew how to make these things. There were embroiderers who had worked in workshops in Constantinople. And once Constantinople fell, they went elsewhere. Maybe they traveled to France. Maybe they traveled to Venice. And so these designs actually have a much greater interchange historically. So I'm always really careful about saying unequivocally, this design is absolutely from here. Because one of the things I've learned over the last few years is you can say that, and then 3 weeks later, you're going to see it in another book labeled a different way.
And it's interesting, too. I remember when my kids and I studied the Byzantine Empire, how much when it fell, you know, we always think about the painters and the philosophers leaving. But, of course, all the textile people went, too. So, you know, we lose that little, just you saying that, I'm like, oh, yeah, I never read that in any of the books. But, of course, textile people were important too. But you always think of the painters, the philosophers, they all. Exactly. That's what, you know,
but you forget about the everyday artisans that made clothes and garments and that were highly skilled and highly trained.
Right.
So, yeah, all of that artistic knowledge was basically taken out of Constantinople and disseminated all throughout Europe. So, it's an important piece. So, everything is much more interwoven. And, you know, as Americans, I feel like we really like everything to be in little boxes. We love our boxes. Oh, my word. Like, this is always this, or this is always this, or this is always this. And I'm like, oh, wow. If you get into the study of textiles, you just don't have that luxury of easily compartmentalizing things.
Okay. You mentioned clothes and embroidery. Folk flourishes. What are you doing?
Oh, I can't wait to talk about this.
Well, that okay, would be now. So, go for it.
Yeah. Okay. So I came up with this idea. So I am a creature of habit, and one of my kind of uniforms I wear in the workshop is black leggings and a white linen shirt, because it's easy, and we get dirty when we're working, lifting boxes and things like that. It's easy to throw in the wash, etc. And I was putting on one of my shirts one day, and I was like, you know, I wish I could like embroider this a little bit or just had something to it. Like, it's just kind of a boring white shirt. And I'm like, I bet I could. And I was like, wait, could I take cross stitch and like put it on garments? And so I started looking into it and I was like, okay, it looks like everybody's done this with waist canvas. I ordered some waist canvas. I tried using it. I hate the stuff. It is so crunchy. It's so crunchy. It's nasty.
Oh, it's gross.
Yeah. Have you guys used it? It's like,
I have, and I hated it. So I threw it all away. It's gone.
Exactly. I hate it. And I was like, oh man. And I was sitting there kind of having a little artistic pity party. Like, there goes my brilliant idea. And then I was like, wait a second. What else do I have in the workshop that might work like this? Because the waist canvas, you're just removing threads, but they're so crunchy and they're so uncomfortable. And like, I'm such a princess when it comes to stitching. If I don't enjoy the process, I just won't do it. I'm like, if it's too stiff or too crunchy or too, you know, the threads stick you or whatever, I'm like, I'm out. It has to be a pleasant process for me. So I was like, how could I do this? So I mulled over this for the last few months and I grabbed little scraps of all of our fabric and I started trying all of our different folk fabrics. And one of our fabrics actually ended up working perfectly. It's actually designed as a fabric for like cushions and things like that in Greece, but it's a 26 count. So it's a little bit larger count, which is really good. And it's got these really soft cotton threads. And so I suddenly realized they're going to actually be much more fun to stitch on and easier to remove. So I started doing that. And literally I was like 10 stitches in the first time. I was like, this is it. I found the technique. So, but I realized like this was one of these things I've realized over the years that like being a tailor and having a lot of sewing experience, I have to really be careful to know where my own blind spots are as a designer and realize if I say something like someone may not actually know what I'm talking about. So I needed to make the technique super duper simple. So for the last 2 months, I have stitched 28 samples and I started like going all over and like, I called my daughter. I said, send me some of the kids' clothes and like, let me, you know, and I got little shorts from Old Navy and suddenly like, I was like, I love this. And then I started showing photos I posted a photo on Instagram a couple, like maybe a month and a half ago. I was like, so I got more response on that one photo than any post I'd done that month. And I was like, okay, I think I'm on to something. And I was thinking about like the visible mending trend and the fact that so many of us buy our clothes and they feel impersonal. You know, everything's mass produced. And I wanted, and I always look at those pictures, like I also study a lot of folk costume. And I look at those pictures and I'm like, oh, I want to wear a shirt that has like embroidery on it. And so I started doing this. And so basically all you do is you just lay the piece. I designed the kit to come with a 12 by 12 inch piece of the fabric. And then I designed a chart that has like, let me think, everyone, we're doing four different kits. Two are releasing next week. That's the Gardens kit and the Woodlands kit. And then in May, I'll release the Seaside and the Geometrics kits. And each kit comes with a 12 by 12 inch piece of fabric, all the instructions, and the floss too. It's 8 yards. So it's essentially like a DMC skein, although we hand wind all our floss, but it's 8 yards of 5 colors. So I've already kind of chosen the palette and I've put in the chart that has 5 or 6 borders and 3 or 4 motifs. It just kind of depends on how big each one is. And so suddenly I was able to add like, I did this pair of shorts for my granddaughter that's got like this little tiny Greek trireme sailing ship on it. It's adorable. And I like was adding these and it's such a small little, like kind of just a little tiny element of like folk embroidery. And I've done linen shorts. I'm getting ready to do linen pants. I've done shirts. I picked up towels at Trader Joe's. And, you know, just the like $7.99 for 3 towels at Trader Joe's. And you can do those like in the border, like the Trader Joe's towels that have the border with like either the red or the blue or the green. I've done all of them. And it's really fun because you can like, and it takes, the other great thing about it, some of the designs, it takes an evening. It's like one night you can like do this. So I'm thinking for like gifting and making your own clothes. And I kind of, and the more people I've shown it to, the more excited I'm getting about it because I think it really fits a need that people want to personalize their clothes. In fact, I've even told my husband, I said, I feel like I'm getting tattoos without having to commit to getting tattoos. Like if I got a tattoo, I'd get a folk embroidery tattoo, but like this way I can put it on my clothes and like change it out or like, you know, do something different. So it's been really fun.
Well, I've got to say, I bought two linen shirts at a warehouse store because they were on sale and they were cheap. And I thought, oh, I'll embroider on them. Yeah. And there they sit waiting for me to figure out what I'm going to do on these silly things. And I'm like, oh, Krista's taken all the work out. All I have to do
is... Yeah, and that's... Okay, that's one of the things that took me a while to figure out, like, about my design evolution. I mean, this kind of harkens back to the early part of our conversation. I hadn't realized that, like, I had all this knowledge and that I was good at actually explaining how to do stuff. And so I've really leaned into that over the last year. And I've done more projects that, like, involve, like, some element of finishing like this. And I finally, like, figured out how to do all the reels and the videos and things like that. So, like, our initial Folk Flourish how-to video is literally 2 minutes. Hmm. I mean, you're going to learn. You see how to do it in 2 minutes. It's really not complicated. You cross-stitch, you over the threads, and then you just pull the threads out with a tweezer. And, you know, every once in a while, you'll get a thread, the fabric, the Folk Flourish fabric, you'll have pierced that with your needle, happens every once in a while. You just pull it out to that point and then you snip it with scissors and it just like comes right out. So it's like a super easy process.
Go buy more shirts, Beth. You're going to need them.
I know. Right?
Yeah.
Seriously, my family is hiding their clothes from me right now. I'm like, wait, I'm going to go through the closets. What else can I do? And they're like, go order other clothes. Don't take our clothes. But it was kind of funny. Even my 14-year-old was like, oh, when she saw the last one, she was like, oh, maybe I want you to actually embroider one of my shirts. And I was like, bingo. That's what I was looking for. I wanted a way that was like fun and playful and easy for people to kind of dip a toe into folk embroidery. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And right now it is very trendy to see embroidery on shirts, but it's either very poorly done. You can see it's either done by a machine or, it is literally, you buy it at the store and the stitches are coming out and you're thinking, yeah, I know to do this by itself would take a ton of time. But to even just to start the process, okay, I've got to pick a design. I've got to find my color palette. I've got to do all the homework. And if most people don't have that kind of time or don't want to take the time. And so pattern, you can just put, and I'm like, I've got a blue jean jacket that I want to embellish more. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that will make it so easy. Because then I can still wear it. I mean, if I do something in an evening, and I take the waist canvas out, I could wear it tomorrow, you know?
Yeah. The longest project I've done is a shirt yoke, and that took me 2 evenings. I did kind of an elaborate, like, tree design on a blue shirt. That's actually, I think, in one of the photos that I gave you. And that took me 2 evenings to do. So, you know, you're only out of the shirt. And the other thing I found, because I have to say, I feel like I've been such a bad grandmother because I have these two beautiful granddaughters and I literally sew nothing for them. Like I sewed for a living and I've sewed nothing for them because I just don't have the time. And I love that I went on the Old Navy website. I got two cute little sundresses and I put like these adorable little sailboats on them and just different little designs. And it made me feel like I was doing something that was like personalized that I had done by hand. But I wasn't having to do that whole part and process that I don't enjoy of like cutting out the fabric and making the clothes and blah, blah, blah. It's like I just got to go straight to the fun part. And that's what I really wanted people to do. I wanted them to like have this opportunity to do this. And I've started to wear my shirts out in public. And I keep getting people like, where'd you get that? And I'm like, I did it myself. You know, so there's always that kind of fun part too of like, oh, this old thing, I did it myself. Yeah. You know, and I feel like I want people to have that sense that,
Christmas kids, the only ones with padlocks on their closets. Yep.
I know, right? Oh, you're so right. I know. The other day I was like, I think I'm going to sneak it. My daughter took one look at me. She goes, you're not going near my closet. I said, okay. She totally called me out. I was like, well, I'm just going to check, you know, what else can I do? Yeah. So far I've done Trader Joe's towels, linen shirts, the Old Navy dresses. Oh, also I did a pair of women's linen shorts and I discovered that like on Amazon, you can get tons of really great linen clothes. So you can just buy something inexpensive on Amazon. I was thinking it'd be great for Christmas. And now I have a friend also who's a quilter. And so I'm actually considering re-releasing some of my like sampler block designs as Folk Flourish quilt blocks. So that'll be one of the next things that I work on is smaller designs that people could actually embroider onto fabric and then it could be sewn into quilt, into a quilt or a sewing project. I really like those kind of crossover projects in the crafting world where, like, you know, knitting combines with sewing or, you know, cross stitch with sewing or whatever. I like that kind of like cross pollinization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, Folk Absolutely. Flourishes, Krista is going to be with us Wednesday on the Stitch Hour, March 20, and then we'll get to see all of this.
As long as giveaways. Yeah, well, you know, cross your fingers. Our printer has been a little bit on the fritz, and my wonderful printer guy actually, like, is driving, like, an hour to the next city to, like, get the part we need so that we can print the kit. He's so sweet. And so we'll see. So hopefully we'll have him ready to go. But right now everything's ready to go. We literally have all the fabric, all the floss, everything's done. But we just are waiting to have the patterns printed.
Yep. All right. So yeah. Wednesday, 8 o'clock Eastern time, March 20. Watch that. And if you listen to these things after the fact, of course, that's recorded on the YouTube channel. But you'll get to see all of these designs and what Krista's doing and what she's done to her kids. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've scarred them for life.
Yes. The bags, I don't know what it is about the little bags that you have that just intrigues me. And you're doing more with those.
Oh, my gosh. This is so funny. Okay, so honestly, this is just totally taking me by surprise. So a couple of years ago, I'd ordered some muslin bags for a little craft. I ordered them actually during the pandemic so that the kids had this craft project they could do with muslin bags. I had these extra bags laying around and we just started having our embroidery hoop kits, my kits that aren't cross-stitched, they're embroidery hoop kits. I started out by stamping those with these 6x6 inch stamps, but it's really time consuming. And so then we like migrated over to having them professionally printed on the fabric, but I still had all the stamps and I had these little muslin bags and I was in the workshop one day and I was like, oh, I wonder if you could stamp those bags. That looks so pretty. So of course I take the stamp, I stamp the bag and I'm like, this is great. It never once crossed my mind that anybody would want to embroider them. Like, seriously, this was such a blind spot. I had no idea. I thought, well, this is just a cool thing to have on your bag that you store your embroidery in. And I'm always telling people, like, store your embroidery, wrap it up, like, put it in a clean kitchen towel or put it in a muslin bag between your stitching sessions. It just helps, you know, to protect against dust or messes or accidents or whatever. And so I had these little bags. And I thought, oh, well, we'll just put a few of them on the website. And like, won't this be great for people who are like new to the craft? And so we put floss organizers in there and a hoop and some needles and that. Well, people started asking, they're like, well, I want the floss and the floss diagram. And I'm like, for what? I was like, you didn't order a hoop kit. They're like, no, for the bag. And I'm like, the bag? What are you going to do with the bag? They're like, I want to stitch the bag. I'm like, oh, like it literally never once occurred to me that anybody would want to stitch the bag. And actually lots of people wanted to stitch the bag. And so, I've had some people, true confessions, had people say, that is so tough to do, like with a hoop. And I'm like, yeah, it's a bag. It never occurred to me that anybody would want to stitch it. So you've got to use like a smaller hoop. So I always tell people like, get a smaller hoop, like a 4-inch hoop. Or you just have to be a little patient. Cause you know, you're sewing something that's already sewn. But a lot of people like that because, again, like Beth said earlier, it's finished. As soon as you knot off that last bit of thread, boom, you're ready to go. You don't have any other finishing. So Pamela and I both hate stamping the bags because it is so time consuming and about every third one doesn't turn out. So it's this totally annoying thing. So I gave Pamela a gift and last fall I said, okay, Pamela, we'll have them made and we'll have a factory like print the design on the bag. She's still thanking me. And so we ended up choosing, but because we had to do like a big production run, we could only choose two of our designs. So now we do the Mira Medallia design. And I specifically chose that one because it is my most beginner friendly design. Like if someone's never stitched before, it has the easiest number of stitches, kind of the easiest satin stitch, everything about it's super easy. And then we chose the Thessaly floral because that one's just been so popular. And so now we have them in a small and a large size. But honestly, super surprised. I had no idea people were going to stitch these. So I'm just as, you know, I have no idea. I have no idea why they caught on. It's also like, I mean, it is a good deal. People get all the like gear, in them, like the work, they get the hoop and the needles and the floss organizer and a needle minder and all that stuff. And we definitely priced it to where there'd be a little bit of a savings there. But yeah, I'm still in shock at like how popular they've been.
Well, they're such nice bags. So then the process is you're stitching with one hand inside the bag then with a small hoop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Small hoop. Yeah. And when the factory ran the bags, they sent me one picture to sign off on and then ended up, but when we got the bags, there was one detail done differently. And at first I was like, oh no. And then I was like, oh, actually this is great. They made the designs larger. They sized up the design on the larger bags. And it's actually kind of fun because now it's not this little 5-inch design. It's more like a 6.5-inch design on the big bags. And the bigger bags are a little easier to stitch because you've got a little bit more room to maneuver in there with a hoop.
Yeah. Well, that's so cool.
Yeah. So yeah, who knew? I mean, I just wanted a pretty bag. So yeah. And now I have 1,000 of them sitting in my basement. So
that you didn't have to stamp. So yeah.
That I did not have to stamp. Oh yeah. The honeymoon is not over yet. Pamela and I are like, oh, these are so great. We don't have to stamp them. Like probably every third day. We're like, these are so great. Yeah.
They're just perfect. I like I said, that was one of those things. I was like, oh, I was looking for that. Just for my niece, because it was done and all she had to do was stitch it. And anyway, perfect, perfect.
Yep. All right. We're running out of time. And I wrote to the DMC people to get somebody to do a show with us and talk about their Echo Vita wool floss. And of course, crickets. No response whatsoever. So you've actually used it. So we'll use you instead of the DMC people. What is that floss?
Okay. Well,
what is it like? How does it work?
Okay, so first off, like I am a huge lover of DMC. The DMC 6-strand cotton floss is all we put in our kits, with a few exceptions. We have a couple of specialty kits that have Appleton's Cruel Wools or something else. But the DMC, we love it because it's so practical, color fast. And for what we're doing, every item we make is at some point going, every design that we produce, every kit is going to create something that might be washed later on. So color fastness is huge. And so DMC, I of course heard about the Eco Vita and I was like, oh my gosh, I can't wait to get my hands on samples. I got it. It is really nice to stitch with. I will say that the color palette is stunningly beautiful. Just beautiful. The 60 shades they chose are fabulous. I was easily able to pick out the whole Mediterranean palette and it's in wool. I mean, I just love the whole product. The only thing about it that doesn't work for us is that it is rated as being color fast, I think up to 30 degrees Celsius water, which is like slightly warm water maybe, or cool water, I'm not certain. But the issue is that as I was stitching with it, I was getting a lot of what we call in the textile industry dye crocking, which means that I was getting a lot of dye shadowing on my hands as I was stitching. And so for right now, my issue is that I need to do more test samples with it. But my greatest concern is that if the dye is coming off on my hands, and I'm not talking like my fingers were blue when I finished stitching with it, like the blue floss. And my greatest concern is that that's not actually going to be color fast. Now, if you're making something, though, that you don't care about that, and you're not going to wash it. I mean, I loved it. I loved the texture of it. It's softer than Appleton's Cruel Wools. I mean, I love Appleton's Cruel Wools. Extremely durable. Really designed for practical household use. I love Appleton's for that. And their color range is amazing. But the Eco Vita is softer. It's a little bit more like lace weight yarn. And I liked it. And I loved the colors. I was super disappointed when the dye started rubbing off of my hands. Cause I'm like, oh no, like I had great hopes for it. But again, if somebody has a project that they don't need to wash it, I would definitely encourage you to try it. It's a really cool product because you know, it's all natural vegetable dyes.
Yeah. But coming off on your hands, I'm not so sure. Yeah.
I know. Well, and then I did discover that it was tricky when I had to rip out stitches. Because I wanted to test that part too. When I ripped it out, you know, it does leave a little bit of that dye shadowing on your fabric.
That was my next question, is how much of it spreads to the fabric.
Exactly. So I'm just not really certain. I mean, I still have my samples and I'm going to continue to kind of test them. And I, what my next step is probably going to be is to like test some of maybe the lighter colors and just do some test block stitching and then wash it and see what happens.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't say that I'm saying unequivocally no. I'm just saying like that was my, and that was just my experience.
And my other concern would be light fastness. I know I have friends that eco dye themselves and the fading factor, if it's in any sort of sunlight, we're doing it on textiles. Yep. If you're putting something at a window that's getting a little sun or you've got a plant on it, of course you can have sun hitting it. So yeah, that would be my concern.
Yeah. And that's actually, that is a big concern, especially with natural dyes. You know, what is it? I think a number of the, is it the tapestries in France, the unicorn tapestries? Scholars think that some of those colors were completely different colors, but that those natural dyes have changed and migrated with light, with, you know, light, losing light fastness over time. So that's, that is a real concern. Again, I would say though, that like for me, I feel like for me, for textiles, I want to work with things that I love and that I enjoy the whole process. So if, I would say for someone who's more process oriented, then go for it. Use the EcoVita. It's just, if you're kind of in that more like heirloom, I need this to last 50 years kind of mindset, they may not be color fast. And that's the other thing too, is like we won't know for a couple of years, you know, until people are stitching and we have products.
Right.
I mean, unless they know that at DMC, maybe they do, but I haven't seen that information. But I love the concept. I absolutely love the concept. And I really hope that this like opens the door to more of these kind of products hitting the market. Because yeah, for me, they had me at wool and natural vegetable dye. I'm like, people, my love languages. And I really, really, so I'm still hoping to work with it and find a way to make it work. But I've got to get over that color fastness hurdle.
Right. Absolutely.
Well, that's just gigantic, especially for you, but I think it's gigantic for anyone. I mean, people count on DMC flosses to hold their dye. And I mean, it's the kind of thing where you don't even think about it when you buy a DMC thread. It's just a given.
Exactly.
Where if you buy an over dye or for someone else, that's your first question. Will it bleed?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And because so many of the people who buy Avalia kits are beginners, you know, we have a large proponent of beginners. I feel like I have to do kind of extra due diligence to make sure that I'm not setting them up for textile failure.
Right. Right. Well, that's frustrating. Okay, DMC people,
yeah,
thanks.
But again,
thanks.
Well, I feel like it opens the door. It opens the door. I don't know that it's frustrating. You know, a lot of times in designing and creating things, it takes a couple of tries to get it to where it works for, you know, the most amount of people. So I'm actually excited to see that a product like this has even hit the market. I think that's thrilling. And I think that all of these things, these are all just problems we'll find solutions to. So I'm actually ultimately very, very positive. I think this is a really great thing that a company as big as DMC is going in this direction is exciting.
Right. It gives us more threads to play with, a different, you know, something else to work with. Yeah.
No, Beth, you're not addicted. Not at all. not at all.
That's my inventory.
Does it come in skeins, balls, what?
Skeins. It comes in, let's see, let me think. Are they 15 meter? I think they're 15 meter skeins.
Okay.
So, but it's one plot, like it's one length. You don't double it or triple it. You know, you don't separate it into strands like embroidery floss.
Okay.
You do need to allow more yardage if you're going to use it.
Yeah.
Like 8 meters of a DMC skein does not equal a skein of EcoVita.
I see. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
So that's the one thing you do want to make sure that you buy enough if you're using it for a project.
Math will be involved, yes. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Math will be involved, exactly.
All right, Krista, we can't wait 4 years for the next one of these. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was a delight.
Yes, thank you.
It was great fun. All right, now Krista with us Wednesday night, March 20, 8 o'clock Eastern time on the FiberTalk YouTube channel live, and we'll get to see the Folk Flourishes work that she's doing and who knows what else we'll talk about, but join us then at 8 o'clock live on the YouTube channel so we don't miss out on that. And avliaembroidery.com is the website, and there's Instagram and Facebook and YouTube too. Do check out the YouTube how-to videos. Very good. Thanks, Krista. Thanks for listening.